Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. In this episode, Nolan Ford will join me to interview Jad Abumrad, the creator and co-host of Radiolab, which airs on public radio stations across the country. Abumrad won a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Grant, in 2011. He grew up in Tennessee, the son of a doctor and scientist. We'll also hear about his relationship with his co-host Robert Grulwich and how long it can take to make a Radiolab episode from conception to airing. Later on, we'll take a break and listen to an interview I did with Christopher Potter. He's the author of the new book, The Earth Gazers, that chronicles the earliest days of the space programs in the United States and Russia, and how the first images of the Earth from space changed our point of view from one of being on a planet to one of viewing it from beyond. First, let's get to part one of our interview with Jad Abumrad. I'm joined by my co-producer, the man on the board, Nolan Ford. Jad Abumrad, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start, as I generally do, to find out about your origins. I saw that you grew up in Tennessee, was it right?
That's correct. Yeah, Nashville, Tennessee.
And your parents were a scientist and a doctor. I'd like to know, what kinds of things really interested you as a child?
I was the kid who spent his weekends kind of huddled in his room with a four-track cassette recorder, creating soundtracks to movies that didn't exist. Because I was this sort of scrawny Arab kid growing up in Tennessee, and I spent a lot of time in my room. And so for me, music was the escape, creating these sort of sonic journeys that, you know, unbeknownst to me, many years later would sort of directly lead to Radiolab. But for me, yeah, I loved music. I didn't have a whole huge interest in science, even though my parents were scientists. That was something I sort of came to much, much later. But mainly it was just making weird sounds on my synthesizers and such.
Did they get you that equipment, like, as a gift or something? Or was that something you really wanted and asked for? How did you first stumble across, hey, I really want to record things?
So my parents forced me to play piano, and they bought me very early on an upright piano. And then when I turned 11, they gave me the choice whether or not to continue. And so I sort of brokered an arrangement with them. I would continue if I could sell the piano and use it to buy an early synthesizer, which at that point it was like the FM synthesizers were coming in. So I think it was like a Roland DX something or other, or a Roland D60 or something. I don't know. One of the sort of like really cheesy, not so good sounding synthesizers. So I sold this beautiful piano for a dumb synthesizer. But from there, I bought, you know, a little cassette recorder, a little four-track cassette recorder, and slowly started getting more gear. And yes, that was sort of the beginning for me.
Before Radiolab, I'd like to know about how you started to really get into radio and production and that kind of thing. Was it first in New York or somewhere else?
Yeah, so sort of going back to the, I don't know, I guess this would be like in the late 90s, early 2000s. I came out of Oberlin. I had studied music and studied creative writing, and subsequently I tried to write music for a living, and it turns out that's really hard, and I was really bad at it. And then I tried to write essays and various things for a living, and it turns out that's really hard, and I was really bad at that. And so I was kind of in one of these like post-college flail moments where I was like, what do I do with my life? And my girlfriend, who's now, at the time, but she's now my wife, she suggested, well, why don't you do radio? It's sort of like kind of writing, and it's also kind of music. It's sort of in the middle ground between these two things. Maybe you'd be good at that. So I started volunteering at a community radio station here in New York called WBAI, which is one of the Pacifica stations. And I just started covering news for them. I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never done any kind of journalism at that point. But they would just send me out with a kit, and I'd run off to City Hall and record whatever protest was happening at that moment and run back and then get the piece on the air, you know, by 4 o'clock. And it was just this great training. And I did that for a year, and then did some longer features for NPR. And sort of to make a long story short, I ended up sort of floating around WNYC around the moment when September 11th happened. And WNYC at that point was a classical music station with a little bit of news sprinkled in. And so there wasn't like a lot of opportunity for people like me to do documentaries or whatever we wanted to do. But I was there, 9/11 happened, and suddenly like New York, well, the entire country shifted completely and was transformed. And the station, as a result, like basically like cleared off its schedule and was like, let's do news. That's what people want to hear. And so suddenly there were all of these blocks of time open up on the schedule. And the program director at the time was like, do you want to just take this little block of time from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. on the AM frequency and do something with it? And suddenly Radiolab was born. Like it happened way earlier for me than it should have. But suddenly I was there filling 3 hours of time every week with whatever I could think of. And that's how it started. And it basically just slowly evolved from that 3 hour mess to a 1 hour show on the FM to meeting Robert Krulwich. And we started to do it together. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Let's talk about your education, because I saw, you know, in college you studied writing and music, and I noticed that it was electronic and electroacoustic music. Could you explain to me what is electroacoustic music exactly?
It was a genre I didn't even know existed until I got to Oberlin. I actually was in sort of the formal composition department, where you sort of write music pieces on paper, but I got really interested in this little department that was in the basement of that building called Tamara, which was an electronic music department. And part of what they did was they studied this little subgenre of post-war avant-garde music called electroacoustic. And essentially all that I take that to mean is that it's acoustic instruments treated electronically. And so you sample, I don't know, the sound of a cello pluck, but then you cut off the attack and you take just the tail of that sound and then you place it in some kind of computer and you stretch it out and invert it and retrograde invert it. And you create these like big soundscapes using acoustic source material. And so what ends up happening is when you hear that stuff, it has a weird sound to it. It sounds kind of familiar because it's some sound from your world, but it's also been made strange. And I always really liked that combination of like the familiar made strange. I kind of feel like that's what Radiolab is. It's these very ordinary questions that lead you to something extraordinary. So it's like very ordinary curiosities leading you through an alien world.
Hey, Jad, this is Nolan. I work on audio production for Blue Dot. How do you go about choosing a topic for an episode of Radiolab? And what makes a great story to you?
I don't know. It's like I can give you one answer today, but it's going to be different tomorrow. You know, I mean, we've been doing Radiolab for years and years and years. And just last night we decided, let's do a story about the indictments that just got handed down by the special counsel, and about like all these, like this Russian interference in our election. And like, who are these Russians? You know, and who are the people that were manipulated? Like, let's just do that. And let's turn around 24 hours. What the hell? You know, it's like, I don't know. Like a year ago, would I have said that's a story that I want to do? I would have been like, no, that's the anti-Radiolab story. But I don't know. Yesterday we decided, no, let's do it. So I don't know. There's like, you know, I could give you a set of ingredients. I could say, well, a story has to have a character that you relate to. It has to have, that character has to do something that's like surprising. Like three times, there has to be like three levels of surprise there. And ultimately they have to lead you to some question or thought or idea that makes you see the world differently. I can kind of give you all those ingredients, but I can also tell you like 500 times when none of those ingredients were there and we still did the story. At the end of the day, I just feel like it just has to spook you on some deep level, like some idea or tale has to kind of just haunt you, and you then want to sort of exercise that. You want to like get it out of you. And like for me, it's like I sort of register why we do stories on that basic emotional level. And, you know, because at the end of the day, I really want every single story we tell to change your life on some level, you know, like to take your perspective and flip it. I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't think the world worked that way. That's crazy. Like, I want that experience to happen with every story. And, you know, sometimes you miss, most times probably. But that's what we're shooting for every single time. And so, you know, you just, you go for the stories that grab you on some deep, visceral level and don't let go. And you think, okay, that's the story we do. Which means, you know, we chase, oh God, like 70, 80% more topics than we ever end up doing. And they, you know, we kill a huge number of stories just because they kind of get almost, but they don't get you all the way there. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of a rambling answer to your question, but yeah, that's how we choose.
Do you have a current favorite episode you've ever produced?
It's usually the last show we've done is the one I'll say is the favorite, just because I always, like, I have an amnesia that sets in at the end of each episode. It's just like your memory gets wiped clean because you spend so much time and energy on each story. By the time it's done, it's like somehow like self-preservation just like makes you forget all the trauma of it. So usually it's like, for me, it's the last one. But, you know, it's like, I mean, yeah, if I take your question seriously, like in the last 6 months or so, I would say my favorites are, like, we did a story recently on the podcast about a guy named Oliver Sipple who one day inadvertently saved the life of a president. He was just a dude who happened to be standing in a crowd, and then right next to him, somebody pulled out a gun from her purse to try and shoot the president. He reflexively hits her hand down, and he saves Gerald Ford's life, which is a heroic thing, a beautiful thing, but it ends up in this utterly fascinating and really tragic way. It ends up ruining his life, that one thing. And so we tell his story, which ends up sort of opening up all these questions about the First Amendment and about the ethical boundaries of journalists and blah, blah, blah. And that was a really beautiful story, and I think about that all the time, particularly these days. I think about an episode we did years ago called Words, which looks at like what happens in the mind of a human when they learn a word. Like if you learn the word like table, like this table, is that just a word that describes this picture of a thing I'm looking at right now? Or does the word on some level feed back on your perception of the very thing and change the nature of the thing as you perceive it? Like if you learn the word red, does that make the color red redder? Is another way of saying it. And there's some really interesting theories about that. And I love that show because I'm, you know, the parent of two boys, and my six-year-old is still kind of learning words. And every time he gets a new word, I always like, what's happening in the head of that little dude? And I think back to the show and I wonder like which theory is right. So that one I think about a lot, but yeah, I don't know. I don't have one favorite. I have many.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll listen to a conversation I recently had with Christopher Potter, author of The Earthgazers. Later on, we'll hear part two of our interview with Jad Abumrad, creator and co-host of Radiolab. We'll be right back. And we're back. Next up, I talked to Christopher Potter. Potter is the author of the new book, The Earthgazers, from Pegasus Books. It's a comprehensive history of the early days of the space program from Robert Goddard and Konstantin Tsiolkovsky and Wernher von Braun. Potter's book focuses on the experience of the 24 astronauts who are the only human beings to have ever seen the entire Earth from space, the Apollo astronauts, who left the Earth to orbit and six times land on the moon from 1968 to 1972. Christopher Potter, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
I really enjoyed the book. It's interesting, and I'd like to know about what the genesis of this project is. The book's kind of about, really, if you were going to read one book and you wanted to get a pretty extensive history of the space program, you could do worse than read your book. But you also kind of have an interesting and unique angle, and it's about the view of the Earth from space, isn't it?
I think I was just idly sitting around one day thinking, what is it that I tend to write about? You know, this is my third book. And I was thinking, well, the other two, there's kind of something about perspective. And I was thinking, you know, it's odd that as human beings, we look out at the world and as individuals, and we don't really have a sense of who we are. There's no looking back on ourselves. And I thought, well, collectively, there's the same issue. There was actually a moment when we collectively were able to look back on ourselves. And I thought, oh, well, perhaps that's something. So I began to look into that. And I thought, well, actually, this is a question that we've been thinking about throughout the whole of human history. What does the Earth look like from space? And kind of amazing to me that we didn't really know. I mean, you know, in more modern times, we had a pretty clear idea. But even in the late 50s, Wernher von Braun was guessing that the Earth would be dazzling because of the sunlight off the poles, or, you know, how blue would it be, how green, how brown. And actually everyone was surprised how white it turned out to be. You know, quite no one had guessed quite how much cloud cover there would be. So we got so used to seeing images from space that I think we've sort of forgotten that we didn't know until very recently what the Earth looked like from afar. And I certainly wasn't quite aware that only 24 human beings have actually had that experience. You know, the Apollo astronauts who went to the moon on those 9 Apollo missions, 3 of them going twice, which is why there were 24.
One of the things that struck me about your book is how you really try to start at the beginning, as it were, with the genesis of our interest in going into space with Konstantin Tsiolkovsky from Russia and Robert Goddard. Could you tell me a little bit about their stories? Because they were really fascinating.
Yeah. Having decided that this was what I was going to write about and that 1968 and Apollo 8 would be the kind of peak of the story rather than the usual Apollo 11 moon landing, then it became obvious that to write about how we got far enough above the Earth's surface to have this site, then it was going to be a story of a certain type of rocket, and it was going to be multi-stage liquid-fueled rockets. And that story really begins, I guess, in 1914, when Robert Goddard, amazingly that early on, took out a couple of patents, one for multi-stage rockets and another for liquid fuel to propel them. And then in 1926 became the first person ever to launch a liquid fueled rocket. Didn't go very far, I think about 184 feet. And it wasn't very big, but nevertheless, it was a world first. And, you know, when the Wright brothers launched their first plane, it didn't go very far either. And I actually didn't know at the time about how Lindbergh was going to become such an important figure in the story. I actually decided to start the book with Lindbergh turning up to see the launch in 1968. I then discovered that soon after Charles Lindbergh had become the first person to fly solo across the Atlantic in 1927, when he was age 25, that he already realized that the future was going to be rockets, and he became interested in who was working on rockets and came across and met Goddard Robert Goddard in 1929, and Goddard had run out of funding. And it was Lindbergh who really managed to get Goddard some funding to continue his research.
And as one of the things that really develops in your book is how, and I found this very interesting, is that he was the only one really who was kind of a philosopher prophet for space exploration, but because he was identified as a German and with Nazi connections, it was difficult for NASA to put him forward in that role. But he did connect with the American public with those famous Walt Disney films that aired on television, as I recall.
Yes, yeah, enormous followings in Collier's magazine, which had a vast readership at the time, and as you say, on the Walt Disney programs, which I think had the largest viewing figures at the time on any program that had been on TV. I didn't actually mention how Lindbergh and von Braun had crossed at the end of the war, just as Werner von Braun was leaving the site where the V-2 rockets had been constructed, and American engineers were busy unbuilding 100 V-2s and shipping all the parts back to America so they could rebuild. Almost few days later, Lindbergh was arriving at the very same place in order to write a report for, I think it was the Navy, to show how far advanced Germany was in rocket science or aviation generally. And I think everyone was rather astonished quite how far along Germany had got.
The other day I was listening to a program on National Public Radio, and the person said that the recent launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket was, you know, the largest rocket ever, which is not true. The Saturn V was a much larger rocket. And what amazes me to think about, even though the Falcon Heavy launch was quite spectacular and interesting by Elon Musk's company and sending his red Tesla out into space with the mannequin Starman, that was quite an amazing achievement. And it definitely pushes things forward. But it's interesting to look back on the reliability of the Saturn rockets, because they never, ever failed us in flight, did they?
No, it was extraordinary. I noticed that with the Elon Musk thing too, that actually I think their statement said the largest operational rockets. And I think then the press didn't quite realize what was being hidden in that operational, that there wasn't that, as you say, a much larger historical rocket. No, von Braun, I mean, the race to the moon ended up really being about von Braun's ability to lift a large payload, you know, out of the Earth's gravitational pull. So in that way, it became a race between him and Korolev, the equivalent engineer in Russia, though Korolev could never quite understand. He thought that von Braun was kind of running everything in the way that he was in Russia. But in fact, von Braun was having to fight to get any space at all. And actually, if his program had been chosen to get the first satellite in orbit, America would undoubtedly have won. It was partly, again, for the reasons you said earlier, that he didn't go down so well because of his past, that Vanguard was chosen over his project and allowed the Russians to get in first.
I'd like to go back to the thesis you have about the view of the Earth from the Earth gazers, the Apollo astronauts. And let's talk about perhaps the most famous of them all, the famous Earthrise photograph that was taken by William Anders on December 24th, 1968 for Apollo 8, which was just a profound moment. But one of the things that I found really kind of interesting was to read the story of the guy who developed those pictures and his role in the story, which is Richard Underwood, right?
Yeah, yes, that's right. And he had early on been found out by von Braun and had been persuaded by von Braun to come and work with him. So von Braun yet again sort of showed his presence and had him attach cameras to his Redstone rockets that were being fired from Cape Kennedy. And Richard Underwood began to realize that here was an opportunity to take photographs of the Earth from high up, you know, 100 miles sometimes. But as you said, they were nearly always, because they were being, the way they were being fired, they were nearly always views of the ocean. And when NASA was first set up, they had no interest in taking photographs at all in the early days. There was even some suggestions that the Mercury capsules shouldn't even have windows in them. And it was he who really fought. And then the astronauts themselves who fought to take photographs. John Glenn had had to buy his own camera, $19.95 from a local drugstore. He took, you know, a couple of reels of pictures. Of course, they turned out to be absolutely useless, but they persisted. And in the end, they took much better cameras. And under Richard Underwood's instructions, NASA ultimately began to see the point of them. By the time of Gemini, and I think it was Ed White who took some particularly striking photographs, and NASA sort of sneeringly called them tourist photographs. And Richard Underwood said, "No, you don't understand. These are pictures of the Earth we've never seen before." And they got the point, or some of them did, anyway.
It's amazing that they didn't seem to get the point, because from a public relations standpoint, if you're going to go do all these things and not show people what it looks like when they're spending, you know, American tax dollars and lots of them to do it, what indeed is the point?
I know, it was odd. And even with the moon landing, they hadn't developed a color camera to take on the moon. Perhaps there wasn't a lot of color to see at that point, but nevertheless, I think they had to fight to get color at all. And it turned out to be color that would be the point, because it's the colors of the Earth that make the Earth so unique seen from outer space. And that was how those first astronauts on Apollo 8, you know, once they got to the moon and saw how drab, I think one of them said it was like plaster of Paris, you know, it was amazing to see, but they suddenly turning back to see the Earth. That was what they found addictive. And that's where the title of the book comes from, because they called it Earth gazing. And whenever they had a moment, they would crowd around these tiny, often smeary windows and see if they could find the Earth.
I remember speaking with the late Gene Cernan, who was the commander of the last Apollo mission, Apollo 17, and talking about being in that beautiful valley, Torres Litra, with the mountains of the moon all around him, and looking up and seeing the Earth. And his cohort was a geologist, Harrison Schmidt, the lunar module pilot. And he said, you know, "Jack, you got to take a look at this. Take a moment to look at the Earth." And Jack, being a geologist, was, you know, really interested in collecting all the samples and looking at the lunar geology, was like, "Yeah, you've seen one Earth, you've seen them all."
I know, it's a great story. I think he was rather ribbing Gene Cernan. I think he knew how to get a rise out of him. But yes, and it was Jack Schmidt who, unlike most of the astronauts who'd said that when they saw the Earth, they were struck by how fragile it was, he, being the geologist, said that he knew how robust it was because he knew what it had been through. Mm. But of course, that's slightly naive, because the Earth had been through all those collisions in order, you know, the comets gradually moved onto orbits that didn't collide with the Earth, and that was what made the Earth habitable for life, you know. So both are true. And that's one of the things I'm really interested in writing about, and comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, this idea of perspective, that you can have different perspectives and both be true. You can love being an American, but you can also love seeing the Earth as a whole and be global. You know, it's not one or the other. They're different perspectives, and both are valuable perspectives to have.
Ooh, perspective. You just made me think of something. It's the Earthrise picture itself, because, you know, I hope our listeners can visualize it. It's that famous, iconic image of the lunar horizon as viewed as if you were standing on the moon and you're looking up and seeing the Earthrise. But that's not actually how it was taken, was it?
No, because they were at a strange angle where the horizon of the moon actually was sort of vertical, and the Earth was seen sort of coming up, or you can't even say up or side, because there is no up or down. It was sort of to the left as...
Because you're in orbit. So the moon is making this kind of vertical profile on your right, I suppose. And then on your left, you see the Earth coming around. So it's that amazing thing that, you know, in space, there's no up or down. Really to say, you know, the North Pole is the top part of the Earth is just a strange bias we have. It's that different kind of perspective you get from being out there.
And I think we would really get it perhaps a bit more if we occasionally did produce photographs even of the Earth with the Antarctic at the top, you know, or at the side, you know, because it doesn't mean anything out there. And that's why I think this extraordinary experience, it's not just the seeing, it's the experiencing of the Earth. And I think this is even more clear in Earthrise, that you see the Earth moving in space, and you realize that it's not just something held there, it's plunging through space, and it's a sphere, and it's brightly colored, and it's not like anything else out there.
Well, on my list of favorite images, Earthrise is probably number one. And then there's another just amazing image that's from Apollo 17. And I believe that was taken by Jack Schmidt. And that's the first time we really get a picture of, and you can add to where this goes, the whole Earth.
Yes, and that was partly to do with the timing of the launch, because all the previous launches had taken place during the day, and it just so happened that when they were at a very good distance away from the Earth, that you could both see it as a sphere in space and see the detail that the Earth was not in full illumination. But this last launch was at night, and when Richard Underwood had said to Jack Schmidt that at a certain distance, I forget exactly what it was, that he should think to take a photograph, and he at that very moment he did, and that was at, you know, a distance to where the Earth was fully illuminated. You see it as a sphere in space, but also close enough that you can see a lot of detail. And again, those two photographs are said to be the two most reproduced images in the history of images. So
it's like seeing a full moon, only you're seeing the full Earth. And of course, that becomes the impetus for the whole Earth catalog, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right. Stuart Brand, who was the editor of the whole Earth catalog, had, before those first images came to public knowledge, he had little badges produced with the logo on it saying, "Why haven't we seen the whole Earth yet?" We don't really know whether his campaign had put any pressure on NASA, but nevertheless, he was really part of the zeitgeist. And in a couple of months before the Earthrise photograph was taken in September 1968, the first issue of the Whole Earth Catalogue came out and had an image from 1967 from one of the satellites, ATS-3 satellite, on its cover. And the magazine had a masthead that read, "We are as gods and may as well get used to it." And Steve Jobs actually went on to say that it was one of the Bibles of his generation. And it promoted communal living, and then promoted the ideas of ecology, and kind of the green movement and Gaia came out of all this.
Yes, it was those early images, the Earthrise and the whole Earth, as you know, the full Earth as seen by Apollo 17, that coincide with 1970 and the beginning of Earth Day and the modern environmental movement.
Yes, well, the word ecology was hardly, I think there was a count of the words, how often the word ecology had been used in the mid-60s compared to how it was used after the whole Earth catalog. It just became one of those buzzwords. It was seeing those images that he came up with the theory of Gaia. But even before that, early ecologists, before they'd seen the image, had guessed that the Earth must look like a living creature. In fact, right at the end of the 18th century, when we had very first been able to rise above the surface of the Earth in balloons, you know, had seen the Earth from a different element, people had commented then that it looked like a living organism, even from that height.
Christopher, it's been a joy to talk to you, and I really enjoyed your book. It just real quick in a, you know, the old soundbite kind of thing, what would be your main takeaway you want readers to have from reading your book?
Well, I'd like people to be able to perhaps think a little more than perhaps they might otherwise have done about perspective and how it relates to us as individuals and a population. You know, this bizarre thing about we don't really see ourselves and either as individuals or collectively. And what are these different perspectives and how we can actually hold different perspectives together? They don't have to be exclusive of each other, but you can be a nationalist and believe in the earth as a whole.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll hear part two of our interview with Jad Abumrad. And we're back. You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. Once again, I'm joined by Nolan Ford as we listen to part two of our conversation with Jad Abumrad, the creator and co-host of Radiolab. I'm curious about how you developed the concept of doing Radiolab with the soundscaping in it, because I can see where that comes from your college background. But the way you complexly tell stories, bringing all of these sounds and things in. How long did it take you to really get that to where it was fine-tuned?
You know, it's funny. I mean, the first, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years of Radiolab are thankfully lost. This was before everything was archived online. And so the first, like, I don't know, God, 70 programs, 50 programs I did, I lose count, have been lost to time, and that's good. They deserve to be lost. But someone recently played me the very first thing that, the very first episode of Radiolab. I don't know, it turned up somewhere in the archives here at WNYC, and I was like kind of floored, because what you hear the very first one is the sound world is there. Because I was coming from, as I described, from this like college, like interest in electroacoustic music and other highfalutin things. And I really wanted it to sound a certain way, and I was layering lots and lots of stuff on top of each other. So the sound was there, but like I had nothing to say. I didn't know how to tell a story. I had nothing to say. I didn't know what stories I wanted to tell. But I did know how it was going to sound. So that was first. And then as I sort of worked it out over the course of weeks and months and years, I began to kind of figure out like, oh, okay, I like these kinds of stories and not those. I sort of want to sound like kind of chatty, but also thoughtful and not just like flapping my gums. So I kind of figured out like where my zone is. And that process took me years. It took me years before I could like, before I felt like I had some grasp on what I was doing. And, you know, like the way in which I tell stories now was heavily influenced, obviously, by meeting Robert, which happened early on around 2004, and just hearing the way that he was telling stories, like just an incredible, playful, mischievous way that he tells stories, that completely infected me. And so I began to sort of kind of mirror him in the way that he uses, like, he's so visual and he's so funny in his storytelling. And so that became a piece of it. So it's just been one slow, long evolution. And, you know, the sound was there from the very beginning, but then the sense of the complexity and the way we stitch it all together, that's something that just took a long time to come online, and it's still something I feel like I'm tinkering with and figuring out.
What are some of the ways that your approach to designing the show has changed since the beginning?
At the very beginning, we were very like, the show was like really trying to push the boundaries in terms of how many tracks we could put into Pro Tools. And some of our sessions from like 2007 were like 120 tracks, bazillion plugins. It just got really like insane and baroque. And we've since been kind of scaling it back. You know, I mean, a lot of what we do now, I'd say is pretty, I don't want to say tame, but it's not very aggressive sound-wise. And so, you know, that's changed over the years. I mean, we will still kind of go bananas at times, but really it's a pretty like mellow and restrained approach to sound design now. And that's different. I'd say that the sound of the show over the years has gotten more overtly electronic. Like we talked about electroacoustic. And so now we're using a lot of like arpeggiated kind of analog synthy kind of things. Whereas before it might be just like a cello drone or something, or some kind of like Celeste through massive reverb. Now it's much more kind of just overtly synthetic. So the sound world of the show has changed characters a little bit. In terms of the fiddly bits, the tools we use, we use a lot of granular synthesis and weird stuff like that to create kind of these sound worlds that feel kind of like gauzy and nebulous, but still somehow familiar. So we've been doing a lot of that stuff recently. I don't know. You know, it's like, it's a much less highly produced thing than it used to be. I hope it sounds mellower and more sophisticated.
Is there much variance to how long it takes to produce each show? Like, what's the shortest it's ever taken to produce an episode, and what's the longest it's ever taken?
You know, I mean, some episodes have gone as long as 2 years, you know. I mean, it's not like constant work for 2 years, but, you know, we did an episode where one of our reporters, Simon Adler, sort of followed this. It was an episode about conservation and the sort of relationship between hunting and conservation. And it followed this one hunter as he traveled to Namibia to shoot a very endangered black rhinoceros in the name of conservation, oddly enough. And so Simon followed that guy for 2 years, and he had to sort of like really patiently wait for the guy to get the right clearances from Fish and Wildlife. And there were all kinds of like hurdles that he had to clear in order to get to Namibia. But so, you know, there are just like these ordinary like roadblocks that you hit when you're reporting a story. And sometimes it takes years or months to get over them. What we end up doing when we're reporting this stuff is we'll follow 20 or 30 at once. And sometimes like one kind of hits a wall and you put it on the shelf for a while and you wait till you have some idea or wait till something happens in the world, then you pull it back off the shelf. So it's like we kind of have to play the odds. Like you have to say, so some of the things, like I just mentioned one earlier, like we're literally turning around this late next podcast in 24 hours. But some of them take 2 years. I mean, it's like, it's so variable.
Tell me about what it's like to work with Robert, because you two have this just wonderful chemistry together. You complement each other perfectly, I think. What's it like to work with him?
Robert is the craziest, smartest, most insane person I think I know, like I've ever met. Like he just has one of these, like, so the thing that's beautiful about Robert, I mean, we do have this kind of crazy chemistry. I think it's mostly him that creates that. I don't know, but he has this crazy thing where like he opens his mouth and you have no idea what's going to come out of his mouth at any moment. Like he's one of the least predictable people I've ever met. And for me, that's really good because I'm a guy that loves to kind of craft and compose and architect things. And I love kind of piecing things together. And he will bring a sort of anarchy. And so the show kind of finds its groove between the tension between like a really like insanely edited and cut together thing and the total chaos of conversation. It's somewhere in between that chaos and that architecture. And I sort of bring the architecture, and he brings the chaos. And it's really a wonderful thing to be able to sit down with him in a studio and tell him about a story I'm working on. And the way that he reacts to it and the things he says are, I can never predict it. And they always send me off in some crazy direction. And then we just like that it's like endlessly inspiring. And the really beautiful thing about my collaboration with Robert is that, you know, like these stories we work on take sometimes like a year and a half, 2 years to make. And you get really lost along the way. And sometimes you forget what it is you're doing and what are we doing again? Is that, how do we know if we're done? But he and I have this like real synergy. Like we always agree when it's ready, when it's done. Like we have a very, very unique shared sense of beauty. And I have never had that with anyone else. And so it's in conversation and it's in those moments at the end of the process where you're lost and you're trying to find your way. And we just sort of look at each other and we'll give each other a look and we'll be like, oh, okay, I think we got it. It's in those two places where he's just, it's a partnership I can't really describe, you know?
Briefly, I'd like to ask you about the MacArthur Fellowship, which you won in 2011 with the so-called Genius Grant.
Yeah.
Which was an award of, I don't know how much money, but it's a sizable chunk of money and with no strings attached. But, you know, saying that there's no strings attached doesn't mean that there are no strings attached inside you,
yeah,
when you get it. I'd like to know what it was like when you first, you know, how did you first find out about, I've won this?
I was in LaGuardia Airport in New York. I had just stepped off a plane. I had forgotten my wallet on the plane, and I was trying to beg my way back on, but they wouldn't let me back on. And then I go down, and they've lost my luggage. And so I'm in that state where, like, I have no wallet, I have no luggage. But I have my phone, and then my phone rings, and this really, for whatever reason, it was a number I didn't recognize, for whatever reason I answered, and it was this dude who really cryptically was like, okay, you've won this thing called the MacArthur Fellowship. You'll never hear from me again. Click. It was literally like that weird. It was like some strange, like,
well, that's like James Bond.
Yeah, it was super weird. And I was like, wait, what? So I called my wife and I was like, I think I won this thing called the MacArthur Fellowship. She was like, what? And we started screaming, and I was like, and it was just dawning on me there, standing in LaGuardia, that had happened. And then there was this long period where they forced you to keep it secret, where it didn't feel real. And then, you know, it when it comes out, you know, it is, I think it was at the time I won, it was like $500,000 over 5 years. Heavily taxed, I might add.
Oh.
And so I was able to take that money and put it toward my kids' education and also like build a little studio in my house so I could record the show while being at home, sort of like to be with them. And so the money was amazing, but it's such that it doesn't like completely change your life. But what was really trippy is that people do like expect you to be way smarter than you are all of a sudden. They expect you to like say things and suddenly people wanted to know my opinion on things, like all manner of things. And I was just like, I was unprepared for like, for that for a while, but then it kind of fades away because people forget and, it's fine. You know, at the end of the day, I just still feel like an idiot. But yeah, for a while it was like, when you talk about the strings attached, there were these strange emotional strings attached for a while that I had trouble with. But you know, at the end of the day, it's like, it's such a gift. It's such an amazing gift. So I just see it as a good thing now.
Jad, I have one last question. When you're not busy working on Radiolab, do you have any favorite podcasts or radio shows that you listen to just for fun?
You know, I'm not, I don't listen to enough podcasts. It's kind of a problem, but the thing that I've just loved recently is Mr. Robot season 2 and 3, which is a TV show. But I've just been like, I've been obsessing about that show. I just feel like it's the best TV that's ever been made. And so That's where I sort of, I mean, I don't have a lot of time. Occasionally on a plane, I'll be like, oh, I can watch something. But yeah, that's mostly TV. Because when I listen to podcasts, this is sort of sad. It feels like work to me. I start to kind of edit it in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try and just watch things that have nothing to do with my life at all.
I can understand that. One last question from me before we let you go. You are traveling and giving talks. Give us a quick description of what you're going to be talking about in your travels.
It's sort of a three-pronged thing. It's sort of on one level the story of how Radiolab came to be, which was a question I kept getting after the MacArthur's. Like, how did it happen? What can we learn from the process? And it was one of those questions I just wasn't prepared for. So the talk became a way for me to sort of like tell a true story about how it happened. But really what it is on sort of a second level is like it's a clinic about storytelling, how we tell stories, what kind of stories we go to, doing some sort of live demonstrations. And then on a third level, it's a kind of meditation about how do you move through doubt? Like when things feel very uncertain, what do you do? What's the good uncertainty versus the bad uncertainty? And so while I was putting together this talk, which was sort of a product of about 4 or 5 years of just thinking, I was doing a lot of interviews with different people in different disciplines, like poker players, psychotherapists, Cherokee shaman, all kinds of different people, like asking him questions about uncertainty. How do you deal with it? Like, what do you think about? And so this talk on a sort of third and final level is a synthesis of all of that thinking and all of those interviews. So it's like sort of three things at once.
Well, Jad, it was thoroughly enjoyable to have a conversation with you today, and I hope you enjoyed being with us here on Blue Dot.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thanks once again to our guests, Jad Abumrad from Radiolab and Christopher Potter, author of The Earthgazers from Pegasus Books. I'm Dave Shlom.
I'm going to make you go. I'll go first if you want me to.
Okay.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio.
You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on.
Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and Dave at Dave Shlom. Wait, it is Shlom, right?
Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz.
Blue Dot is engineered and co-produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford.
And remember, from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.
End of message.